at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. This week, we're looking back at some of the year's most important stories and themes from across the African continent. Was 2021 a year to remember, or one we'd rather forget? We'll bring you in-depth analysis and reporting as we look at the stories, events, and people behind the year's biggest headlines. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Yet another year defined largely by the COVID-19 pandemic, as communities worldwide try to cope with loss and change, as governments try to stop the spread of the mutating virus, and as we all try to recover from the devastating impact of this pandemic on people's lives and livelihoods. Across Africa, there were big changes in the world of politics. We saw a new generation of young climate change activists speak out for the continent on the global stage, and the beginnings of a big shift in the way Africans do business with each other. This week and next, we'll bring you the best of our coverage and major news moments across Africa in 2021. Now, earlier, I invited two guests to join me to discuss some of those most important moments and themes. Emira and Vincent, welcome. Emira Woods is with Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity and a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. Vincent McCorry is the managing editor for TV at VOA's English to Africa news service. Vincent and Emira, great to have you here. When is it not quite the year? Globally and particularly across the African continent. And it seems like there were so many important developments and milestones, events that took place either because of the pandemic or in spite of it. We can't obviously possibly talk about all of them in this episode, but I do want to take a look at some of the major themes that really stood out to the two of you this year. But of course, this year started out on a really positive note. On January 1st, Africa's free trade area opened for business. And just to remind our viewers here, the Continental Free Trade Area is meant to boost intra-Africa trade. It's supposed to promote industrialization, create jobs, and improve competitiveness of African industries on the global stage. And so, Vincent, this is, of course, not something we would see happening before our very eyes, but it was quite historic, wasn't it?
It is a historic move, and it's commendable that Africa, realizes that it needs to unite more, because Africa is a huge continent with a big market, 1 point something billion people, such a vast continent with so many natural resources and minerals that you can, that are really of great value. And when you consider the fact that the levels of development in Africa are kind of are very uneven, so you really want to take advantage of the strengths of each region, each country, in order to kind of grow together as a continent. So uniting economically is one of the most, I think, the easily achievable thing before you can even think about any political unity that has been a dream of many Pan-Africanists. Now, the caveat is that our continent still, suffers from a lack of infrastructure. You cannot have a successful intra-continental trade without good infrastructure that connects these countries. You need to first even connect regions within one country in order to really succeed in, moving goods from one place to another, in order to unify even one single country. And then you need to create those, kind of infrastructures across countries. So we need railway networks. We need amazing highways that can take a person from Kenya to Nigeria and to Egypt if that is possible. And I know that is part of the discussion here, and that is where China is coming big into the continent, because every country is trying to get those things in place. So until such a time as when we'll have a very good kind of network of railways and trains and very, beautifully functioning ports, I don't see this really achieving a lot other than looking so beautiful on paper. And we need to really take it away out of the paper and actualize it by speeding up on the infrastructure front.
Emira, what is your take? And talk to us a little bit about how this type of intra-Africa trade is also meant to empower Africa's women, many of whom run small, informal enterprises. And this is supposed to give them improved access to trade opportunities, right?
So typically, you know, because of the colonial legacy, it's actually easier to travel or to have trade with former colonial countries than with your neighboring countries. And so being able to create a vision where Africa is coming together as one, I think it is revolutionary. It is vital, right? And it is living a Pan-Africanist dream. I think being able to, what we see now, let's say, for example, with this all the discussion around the Omicron variant and the rest, closing of borders, right? The Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement will push against those types of knee-jerk reactions to shut borders from your neighbors, push against xenophobic attitudes that reject, you know, when people from one border, from Zimbabwe, come over into South Africa and will reject that xenophobic kind of pattern and trend. So I think it is visionary in its approach. It is needed for the continent. And I think it also pushes back against what has become really almost dangerous, picking one African country against the other, bilateral trade agreements where the US and Kenya or China and Zambia, wherever the country is, right? These bilateral agreements that are often made in a way that privileges a geopolitical actor and not necessarily in the best interest of the people. Now we move away from these bilateral agreements and look towards the continent as a whole, advancing its own interests. So I think we've got to look at opportunities where new stakeholders are coming to the table. You know, and it is primarily those that have been in the informal sector that have been a part of that cross-border trade, including women entrepreneurs that have been a part of that trans-border trade for generations. And it's creating a way where their activities can be part of a formal structure that brings a greater movement across those borders, that creates opportunities where there are tariff barriers reduced when you're crossing those borders, and that those entrepreneurs and you know, ordinary people in the informal sector, those workers have an opportunity to advance goals. I think it is a critical part.
And before I move away from this topic, I'll be brief. You know, the other aspect of actualizing a free trade across the continent is really security. Instability. Now, the challenge that Africa faces, and I don't want to throw a damper on this agreement, is that we have a mix of countries. In this mix of countries, not only do they have different levels of economic development, but also sense of security. Can my sister just go to Mogadishu and try to take a business there to trade? Can we travel across the continent through South Sudan and do business there, invest and, you know, sell and exchange stuff? We as a continent really need to think so hard on how can we attain to a level of peace, a level of security that can facilitate an intra-Africa trade.
And just to wrap up sort of this segment, Emira and Vincent, I want to know from you, what were some of the other trends that really stood out to you this past year that you think we should really draw lessons from?
Well, I think on the, unfortunately, the negative one comes first when you think about the increase in repression. And for me, one of the standout things in 2021 was really the abduction of the Rwandan sort of hero from the Hotel Rwanda, Paul Rusesabagina, to be literally kidnapped and put on a plane and then show up in Rwanda. You know, have a sham trial, and then to be then convicted, right, through this sham trial. I think it is a grave concern, particularly issues of opposition and criticism for the government. The government in Rwanda is now not only Paul Rusesabagina, but journalists, YouTubers, a long list of people, poets, who have been either disappeared, arrested, or killed. And so I think it's that notion of increased repression and real lack of the international community kind of stepping up to critique that was a major concern. So that's on the negative end. I guess another one that was concerning was around Israel really pushing to have a role at the African Union. In 2021, I think many of us were shocked that would even be allowed. And so a real pushback on the continent, I think, particularly from young people and young leaders to question that, what has happened to create a space for an African Union to even consider Israel becoming a member. I think on the positive end, all of the activism around climate and climate justice that is coming from the continent has been extraordinary. It's been invigorating. So it's young people, it's young leaders to have, a young Ugandan woman, that's on the cover of Time because of her activism on climate justice, I think is extraordinary. That's Vanessa Nakate, is one of many dynamic voices that are demanding not only an end to fossil fuels, oil, gas, and especially on the continent, but visioning a future that is driven by an economy that's a green economy that works for everybody on the planet.
The really sad and heart-wrenching one is the conflict in Ethiopia, in the northern part of the country, the conflict between the Ethiopian forces and the Tigray TPLF. That has continued to be the leading story throughout year 2021. And it was so sad to see how many people have died, how many women have been raped, how many children have been orphaned. And so that really, weighs down our hearts, and it continued being so. The other outstanding thing, I think, was the case of Sudan, where citizens, especially when the military decided to take over from a civilian prime minister, where citizens came out and said, no, never. And the military, of course, with pressure from other external forces, was forced to go back and again reinstate the prime minister. I think that was something really remarkable, that the people are saying, we are no longer scared of the armies. We own the country. The military does not own the country. So that was a shining example. Now, a minor story that somebody may not think of, for me, was South Africa being the first country to identify Omicron. In as much as the South Africa has taken the flak for that, and for some reason has been victimized for doing that, but I think that was the brilliance of African researchers came out there, and I think South Africa should be commended for having such an advanced research center that was able to identify Omicron. It did not necessarily come from South Africa, but South Africa identified it first.
And Vincent and Emira are back with me for our next discussion. We were joined by VOA's Arzuma Compaore to discuss the year's highs and lows, hits and misses, and the accomplishments of Africa's young people. Joining us now is Arzuma Compaore. He's a television reporter and anchor with VOA's French to Africa news service. Arzuma, thank you so much for being here. Now, you cover French-speaking African countries. Now, of course, I don't want to delineate the conversation along the colonial map here, but you do cover this region. And so give us a sense of the stories that have really grabbed the headlines as far as your reporting goes this year.
I'd say that first that comes to my mind are the different coups that we had in Mali, in Chad, and all those coups were, you know, something that was kind of like, you know, people kind of sensed it, and then the surprise of it. And I want to also come back to Mali, particularly where we had twice a coup. The first time the military came, I was still the former president, Ibrahim Ibeka, and then put together a power that was supposed to be, you know, taking them through the transition. And then the military decided that, you know, what was happening was not to their taste. So they came back and did another coup. After all of those coups, Guinea was the last one to come into the game. We just felt like Africa was back in that, you know, era where we had coup after coup after coup back in the 80s. There's also, of course, you know, the COVID and the amount of people that we lost to COVID. You know, like a lot of the celebrities, a lot of the presidents, most of them, were people that we connected or we reported or we talked, interviewed, and, you know, just having to report on their death and just saying that, you know, it was related to COVID. So it just made COVID even more of a threat. The other thing that really is something of concern that, you know, we reported on was the overall hunger situation in all those places that, you know, were struck by terrorism, and like so many have to face the reality of becoming refugees in other places or internal displaced in their own countries, having to face the rudiment of not having food, not being able to take care of themselves, and relying on the government to help them. Yet, in many of those places, we noticed that the government was pretty inexistent. And that is also some of the reasons why, you know, you had all those insecurity and, grand banditism, you know, people just took advantage of the situation. Think about Burkina Faso, especially in the north and in the east side. You know, you have villages that, you know, could not function anymore. Schools closed, you know, hospitals, all the administration is just, inexistent. So this became much of a problem, and also generated a lot of concern going forward.
And Vincent, taking a sort of bird's eye view here of developments across the continent this past year, we saw similar trends in other parts of Africa. And jumping off from what Arzuma has just said, this sort of youth-driven wave of public discontent around political and the political and economic systems in their countries.
Yes. So in all these places where we saw upheavals, one of the most remarkable thing was how the youth especially become aware of the role they can play in society in demanding just and more tolerant and democratic country. Now, we know that in a particularly country like Sudan, where youth-driven demonstrations and protests literally drove Omar al-Bashir out of power and created a system, unfortunately, still maintained a military foothold in the power structure. But it made, there was a big statement that was made there that the young people of Africa can no longer, take on this, oppressive regimes lying down. But that wasn't necessarily witnessed everywhere, because we know that in some of the other countries that have been mentioned, like in the case of Mali and in Guinea and other places, the military managed to overthrow governments. And it was a really worrying trend, because this was supposed to have been something of the past. In the past, the 80s, when we were so used to military coups, but to see the this coming back again and becoming almost like a norm. Several military coups in just 1 year was such a a worrying trend. And at this moment, we know that once the military has tasted power, there's always the danger that this could become a trend, as Zuma mentioned in some of the reporting. And the trend could become, you know, it could start spreading or extending to other parts of the continent, which is terrifying. But we know that one of the reasons why this happens is that the citizens of a country become so desperate for positive change, and in the absence of democratic structures that can facilitate, progressive civilian rule, then the military looks like a viable alternative. But unfortunately, and I always say this, militaries are not democratic institutions by nature, so they can never guarantee democracy. They can never guarantee freedoms, but what we can say is at the moment there's so much awareness among the youth of Africa across the continent. Even if you went back, beyond the year, even before 2021, we saw that the young people of Africa can no longer be ignored. And now they're demanding more than ever before for justice, for a democracy. We saw this in Nigeria with the protests against SARS, and the government had to back down and, in fact, end SARS. Literally, they dismantled that unit.
Emira, is part of this disconnect also about young people seeing that leadership is not as representative of the demographics of their country? I mean, I couldn't help but notice in the case of the coup in Guinea, for example, how there's this younger, strapping military coup leader riding this wave of discontent, citing poverty and endemic corruption as reasons to overthrow Alpha Conde. Now, in places like Mali, we've also seen coup leaders really being applauded and cheered on by the crowds in the past. Is this what change looks like for some people?
I think we have to first underscore that this new wave of coups and counter coups is also really, we've got to critique it from a geopolitical lens. I think it's important, right, to recognize that we are now, this is the 20th year of the so-called global war on terror. And so what you have had is a real privileging and building of relationships with militaries on the continent that you see, you know, it's almost like, you know, the hens coming home to roost, right? It is frightening, the elevation of military leadership by geopolitical players, including the United States, right? So, you know, these allies in the so-called war on terror have then gone on to, you know, unleash repression and then launch coups. And I think we've got to say that and recognize that it's clear when we're talking particularly of places like Mali, but others in the region as well. So I think, you know, there is almost a need to rebalance and to look at what leadership means and what democracy means. And democracy, yes, it is clearly the ballot box, but it is also a thriving, particularly a press, a free press, opportunities for people to assemble and to protest and to freely assert their rights and their views and to choose their leaders freely and hold those leaders accountable. But what you have had in this past year, particularly with the COVID crisis, this pandemic, is almost like a closure of the political space. And so you've had opportunities for increasing authoritarianism. And, you know, so yes, people have pushed back and found ways to protest. But at the same time, you have had the military strengthening its hand to the extent that, you know, they've actually taken over. And I think we've got to look at both the internal dynamics and the geopolitical dynamics as we examine this year of what happened and try to bring some measure of accountability.
Emira, I do find it quite striking that just as there seems to be this, you know, almost fatigue with the war on terror in these African countries, we also you know, are seeing this frustration among young people about the constant military presence of former colonial powers. But at the same time, there's now concern and criticism about what looks to become a story of modern colonialism featuring China and Russia.
Well, I think there is always that threat, right? It's like looming large of both the colonials, the former colonial powers, and these new players. And some of them are, you know, new players that have a very large footprint, like China. Some of them are, you know, players that may have a smaller footprint, you know, certainly Turkey, Saudi Arabia, there are a number that are, you know, underway. Israel, I feel like we can't leave that out, right? You know, trying to gain greater foothold on the continent and to assert both their dominance where they can in political processes and especially determine economic decisions for the country. So I think there is a concern, you know, and I think the joy of movements on the continent is really rejecting all of that and saying that we need to decolonize our world, right? And assert both the leadership of particularly African indigenous communities, the vision that's coming forward from social movements and young people that are demanding issues like climate justice and, you know, and an economy that works for all, that ends inequality, that ends unemployment. You know, this is the vision that is being put forward by social movements. And it's very much a contest between that vision and sort of rolling back the clock to the colonial and neocolonial era.
Now, Arzuma, you're a man of many talents. You also cover the worlds of African film, tech, and culture. So what were the stories that really made you hopeful and that you'd say, you know, gave you life this year?
You know, of course, all was not that dark. You all also know that, you know, for me, movies and cinema is the biggest thing. My joy to see that Fess Parker was able to be held back in Burkina Faso, and the amount of good feedback that I got from, you know, people on the that on the field about, you know, this the feeling that, okay, it is hard, it is not easy, but we are resilient. We still hope that, you know, tomorrow is going to be better, and that is something that movies are able to do. There's a lot more interest from, you know, big streaming media like Netflix for African content. And all of this is something that pretty much makes me smile, because I know, you know, once more, we're getting closer to making a plane, to level the plane for everybody when it comes to the image that we produce outside of our own country for the world. So the more we produce, the more we put our own stories out there, the more we're inventing, like we're telling people, hey, you have to count with us. You cannot take us, you know, like we don't exist. So no, that is something that I'm very excited. And I was able to see that all through 2021, a lot of people, a lot of youth, you know, growing, getting like millions of followership on social media, becoming powerful, making money out of that too, which is very important. And, you know, I'm sure 2022 is coming with something that is going to be even bigger than that for internet, for, you know, the new African influencers and that are out there.
Vincent and Emira, please stay with me for our next segment as we say goodbye to Arzuma Compaoré. Arzuma, thank you so much for your reporting and for joining us. I appreciate your time, and we'll see you in 2022. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, confusion and frustration in Angola over vaccine imposition and Russia's Sputnik shots. VOA's Myra de la Salette joins us with the details back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. We're discussing some of the major stories and themes across Africa in 2021. Here at the Voice of America, our various language services cover stories across the African continent. And so for this conversation, we're joined by a colleague from VOA's Portuguese News Service. And a warm welcome back to our panelists, Africa strategist Emira Woods and Vincent McCorry, who's the managing editor for TV in VOA's English to Africa News Service. And joining us for this discussion is Meira de la Salete. She's a multimedia journalist with VOA's Portuguese News Service. She's also the host of the interactive show Health in Focus. Meira, thank you so much for joining us. And just for our audience to know, you cover Portuguese-speaking African countries, particularly Angola and Mozambique. And so, Meira, yours is, of course, a health program. The pandemic has, I'm sure, been top of mind for all of your listeners. What was the single biggest story you've covered this year on your show?
So I would say thank you again. First, thank you for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here and being able to talk about this issue that I think the biggest issue is, what is this pandemic? Is this really true? Why aren't they more focused on malaria instead of COVID that is barely killing people in our countries? So just so people understand, I'm talking about Portuguese-speaking countries in Africa. Our main audiences are in Mozambique and Angola. And in Angola, that is a 100% endemic country, malaria is still the main issue. So that was one of our challenges, was to explain to people that this is real, this is a pandemic that everyone needs to pay attention to. But the back and forth with our audiences in our show is a kind of an interactive show. People can ask questions during the show. It's a live show. They can send questions during the week, and we have guests talking about the health issues. And misinformation, I believe, was kind of the main problem that I saw throughout the year on our reports. We would ask people in the streets if they would get vaccinated, what did they know about COVID-19? And the question was always, I don't think I would get vaccinated unless the government makes me do it, and which Angola, for example, did make it mandatory. And so to wrap it up, misinformation and the concern about malaria were kind of walking hand to hand on this COVID situation.
Emira, you know, something I found really puzzling, even early on when we started hearing about a vaccine hesitancy and all sort of like misinformation around this vaccine. I'm sure I can speak for all of us here when I say we were all fully vaccinated as children. It was just part of life. But it's different with this vaccine. And of course, the misinformation, the disinformation is what is different here. Emira, how much of this is driven by false information originating from the pandemic politics that we see here in the United States?
Well, yes, I think the issue is, you know, it's not just Africa, it's global, right? We're misinformation. I mean, it's the downside of all of the positives of the internet, but the negative side is, you know, the misinformation flows much more quickly even than the facts, right? So I think, you know, what we have to continuously reinforce is sort of evidence-based, science-based, data-driven decision making, and to make sure that people have the information they need to make decisions for themselves, their families, and their communities. I think there is also an issue of trust, you know, in terms of the governments and making sure that that there is a relationship of trust where when a health minister says, you know, give guidance, that guidance is then received, shared, and accepted, and also, you know, local leaders, including faith-based leaders, to be able to have access to the science and the data to also give proper information to those in their networks and traditional leaders as well. So I think the countries that are doing the information dissemination well are the countries that are using all of those traditional and non-traditional mechanisms to get information out. But I think we have to also say that, you know, that what we recognize with COVID is that this pandemic is likely just the beginning, right? That there will be future pandemics. And so the importance of building health infrastructure on the continent that will do diagnostics, that will put out health information adequately enough using local languages, using traditional languages and the rest, using, you know, music, art, and all of the forms that we so vibrantly have within our communities, our countries, our cultures, right? So I think it is recognizing that we are, in a whole, literally a whole new world where these pandemics will continue. And we've got to be able to build the infrastructure, not only for COVID response, but for these future pandemics. And part of that infrastructure is making sure that there is the support for manufacturing on the continent of vaccines, for manufacturing of diagnostics, of all that is needed to have the full response to not just COVID, but to future pandemics as well.
I just wanted to make a quick point on misinformation, because this is perhaps the first time that the world has had two pandemics, two global pandemics, the pandemic of COVID-19 and the pandemic of misinformation. For the first time, because of social media, because of the internet, we have had misinformation globalized. It used to be that misinformation against vaccines like those of polio were localized. People would have a certain kind of beliefs, and they will spread this in the community, and people start believing that perhaps a vaccine against polio is meant to sterilize kids so that they will not give birth, and that could spread. There could be some kind of religious leaders who had some suspicions about vaccinations. But for the first time, we've had misinformation that is globalized, but is accessed by everybody in every nook and cranny of even the smallest African country, because people now have access to information. This misinformation came from people who are medical practitioners, doctors, and they put it out there very beautifully with graphics and diagrams, and they showed why this virus is from such and such a thing, perhaps it doesn't even exist, or this vaccine has been engineered by somebody to kind of try to manipulate how we function, or perhaps have some implications for how we will live in the future. So for the very first time, there was globalized misinformation that was driven not just by some nobodies, but in fact by credible political leaders, by medical practitioners, by very highly educated people of all races. So those in our continent could easily say, if even in these countries, even in Europe, in the US, in Brazil, people believe this, who are we not to believe that this vaccine should be suspect, that we shouldn't avoid this? Now, talking about what the pandemic has shown about Africa, yes, the pandemic has laid bare the reality that we are still very, very far from being able to take care of ourselves. When this pandemic happened and the entire world closed down, there was lockdown in all countries, and nobody could travel to any other country. No president, no leader, no rich person could go to another country to get medical care. It became clear that the continent of Africa needs to start thinking about how to become self-reliant, how to depend on itself. We went to, when we started sourcing for vaccines, what happened? We were at the back of the queue because the vaccines were being produced in the West, or they were being produced in Asia. We're still stretching our arms and saying, please give us more vaccines. Please bring us more vaccines. And at the same time, we're struggling with the infrastructure of distributing these vaccines. Just recently, we reported about 1 million COVID vaccine being destroyed or expiring in Nigeria, and many more have expired across the continent of Africa. It is time to start working on building the infrastructures that will enable the continent to take care of its own needs. That includes the manufacture of vaccines and other forms of medication that can address not only global pandemics like this, but even other illnesses like malaria, HIV, and so on and so forth.
And Amira, we are, of course, all now very familiar with the terms vaccine inequity and vaccine hesitancy. But there is some controversy in Angola, especially around vaccine imposition. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, sure. And on a segue of what Vincent was saying, Africa being on the end of the queue, not just that, but also not having the choice to pick, you know, you get what you get what we give you. And that's what happened with our countries. Angola and Mozambique, for example, one of the first vaccines was the Sputnik from Russia. And from our experience, we don't really have a lot of drugs from Russia in our country. So that's a start, you know, like a false start already. It's why are we getting this? This is not usually the country that we get from, right? This is not the right origin. And then after people were vaccinated with Sputnik, and that happened in Angola, when the vaccine certificates, the international vaccine certificates came, people that were vaccinated with Sputnik weren't recognized. That vaccination wasn't recognized. So traveling abroad was still an issue. There was constraints about it because the vaccine wasn't recognized internationally. So even though you got immunized, it doesn't count. Why? The big question was, why would we get this vaccine if it's not good enough for others? And that mistrust that Emira and Vincent were talking about ties into this. Not just, and I think this is just this big snowball that grows and grows, that is the two pandemics that Vincent was talking about, the social activists, the doctors, all these opinion makers that people trust, bringing all these pretty graphics that are fake. And then on top of that, you actually get a vaccine that is not recognized. So this just adds to this mistrust. This just adds to this discomfort of what is this pandemic about? What kind of people are we? It's another stamp of this we call second class citizen, I guess, second class human being. And the myths of all of this. Then came the Chinese vaccine. All of this creates all these questions that people can't really wrap their heads around. We were talking about Africa being isolated, and I will bring right now the Omicron variant. Africa wasn't able in general, and Omicron brought that again to unite. You know, so we had countries like Angola blocking their its own neighbors. You know, the same way that the Western said, okay, these six countries cannot fly into our countries, they close borders with South Africa, with Mozambique. Angola did the same thing. And we saw the president of South Africa saying, it's not okay, we've been helping our neighbors, and now our neighbors are closing the doors. And that's another lesson on a negative point that we need to learn here. Europe United, right? Asia, in a way, did the same thing. But we as Africans, we always try to side with whichever part we believe it's the strongest, and we don't really come together. And Omicron showed that again. This Mozambican author and this Angolan author too, they said last week that this is an apartheid. This is the pandemic apartheid that is being created. Strong words, very strong words. But people cannot help to think that that's what's happening here. We cannot just close. We cannot just block others. There are ways to do it. And we have been seeing that in other continents, that it's possible to do it without just blocking other countries and making it harder economically, especially now that it's summer in our countries, where tourism is the source to grow the economy. And this is just like a punch in your guts. Like you were saying in the beginning of the show, is that, or of this conversation with me, is that we are used to get vaccinated. Yes, it's not anything new. Our mothers, they have that at the very beginning. When they give birth, they have the whole plan to vaccinate us. And actually, we had one town hall meeting with the representative of the group that is the task force in Guinea-Bissau for coronavirus. And she said that it was with the women that they were working to make sure that everyone would get vaccinated. Still, access to the vaccine, you need vaccines so people can actually be immunized.
Mara de la Salette is from VOA's Portuguese News Service. It's been great to have you with us. See you soon. Thank you. Emira Woods is with Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity, and she's also a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. And Vincent McCorry is the managing editor for TV at VOA's English to Africa News Service. Emira and Vincent, thank you so much for being my companions throughout the show. I really appreciate your perspectives, and I do admire your stamina. Hope to see you again in 2022. Thank you for your time. Stay with us here on Straight Talk Africa. Still ahead, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has just returned from a trip to Africa, and U.S. President Joe Biden has concluded a two-day democracy summit. What does it all mean for America's relationship with African countries? And we'll tell you what we know about the Biden administration's Build Back Better World plans. VOA's Patsy Wedekuswara joins us from the White House when we come back. Welcome back. As U.S. President Joe Biden approaches his first anniversary in office, we're taking a closer look at his administration's plans to improve U.S.-Africa relations. How have the events of 2021 and the politics around the pandemic shaped the relationship between the United States and African nations? VOA's Patsy Wedekuswara joined me from the White House with details. Patsy, thank you so much for joining me. You're at the White House day in and day out, and you've really had a front row seat to the year that was for the Biden-Harris administration. Patsy, what would you say were the major developments that really defined this White House's foreign policy approach towards Africa?
So the Biden foreign policy approach towards Africa was actually just laid out by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Abuja in November, where the main message that he is bringing from the Biden administration is that they want to stop treating Africa as a subject of geopolitics, but rather as the major geopolitical player that it has become. Now, there's a certain caveat, there's a certain humility that Blinken is saying. He's saying that, I know I am not the first Secretary of State who comes to Africa and say that things will be different and better. However, Secretary of State Antony Blinken did outline a couple of key areas of focus from the Biden administration on Africa. The first one is obviously global health and pandemic recovery. The U.S. wants to treat Africa as a partner to get towards a recovery quickly, both in terms of vaccine donations and vaccine assistance. As you know, the U.S. is by far the largest donor of vaccine doses around the world. The pledged doses is 1.25 billion doses. And out of that, that has already been delivered as 250 million doses, about 50 million of those going into African countries, 45 African countries in the continent. The second area of cooperation is on climate change. I think the U.S. fully recognizes that Africa, in terms, you know, comparatively globally, is not a large contributor of global greenhouse gases, but they are suffering disproportionately from the impacts of climate change. So the U.S. really just wants to support Africa and other developing nations to transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, for example. This has been a pledge by wealthy nations for several years now to provide the so-called Green Fund, about $1 billion a year to developing nations. And that pledge has just remained that. It hasn't been delivered. And so this is something that the Biden administration acknowledges and wants to work better towards. And the third area is, of course, a very important area in Africa, which is infrastructure building. Now, we know that China is a major and a dominant player in development of infrastructure in Africa through its Belt and Road Initiative. And now the U.S. is at least starting to lay out the groundwork to offer an alternative, which what the Biden administration calls its Build Back Better World. B3W, that is the acronym. As you know, we love acronyms in Washington, D.C. Now, it's still very nascent. We still don't know much about it, how much it is, how big is it? Is it new money? Is it real money? And they're not going to launch it formally until early next year. But we know that Deputy National Security Advisor Dalip Singh has already gone to several countries in the African continent in recent weeks to do a listening tour to kind of scout projects, infrastructure projects. What can the U.S. do to help Africa, to partner with African countries to develop infrastructure, knowing that they cannot be a viable competitor against China in terms of the actual funding and, you know, amount of dollars. So they're really focusing on areas which they see China is lacking, including climate change, including gender equality and digital technology. And the other thing that they're also really focusing on is on the issue of democracy and human rights. We know that President Biden hosted the Summit for Democracy on December 9th and 10th. And there's a certain humility as well here, where the Biden administration is answering to these criticism of, does the U.S. still have moral high ground to host a democracy summit, considering its own democratic backsliding, the January 6th insurrection attempt by Trump supporters, as well as attacks on election integrity.
And you could say this was the year that the politics around the pandemic really laid bare the imbalances in the relationships between African countries and those in the global north or Western nations or whatever geopolitical label you want to use here. But we saw friction and real frustration among African countries on two fronts: the inequities in the global vaccine distribution efforts, and of course, this recent round of travel bans after South African scientists detected the Omicron variant in their country and did the right and responsible thing. They sounded the alarm. But the recent travel bans are largely seen as a slap in the face to the South Africans. How has Joe Biden walked this tightrope?
Well, certainly his aides are very careful in saying that the travel restrictions against South Africa and several other African countries is not a form of punishment. In fact, they're commending South Africa for its speedy response, for, you know, acknowledging it and also informing other countries, including the United States. They're saying that the travel ban, the decision towards a travel ban, is really just to give U.S. officials, health officials, and experts more time to study the Omicron variant before they can make their decisions. And they really are stressing that they want to lift the travel ban as soon as they can. I think that the U.S. realizes that they need Africa as partners in this fight against COVID-19. They realize the global vaccine inequity. And other than the vaccine donations that I have outlined, I think the U.S. is also supporting this this so-called TRIPS waiver proposal by South Africa as well as India at the World Trade Organization to waive the patents on not just vaccines, but also other technologies that would enable countries, including middle-income countries in Africa, to produce their own vaccines. They're basically saying, give us the recipe of these vaccines so that we can produce it ourselves without being sued by these pharmaceutical companies. Now, the criticism against the U.S. here is that even though the U.S. says it supports the measure, it's not really putting any diplomatic weight behind the push for it at the WTO, because it's really been months since the U.S. says that they support it, but there is absolutely no movement there. There's still a couple of holdouts, including from the U.K. and Switzerland and Germany, and the U.S. has been criticized for not pushing, for not using its diplomatic leverage to get those countries towards yes, saying that they will be able to open the recipes for these vaccines. Another point that I want to underline is the fact that the U.S. realizes that these African countries have had a lot of experience and a lot of expertise in dealing with the pandemic, in together working with the U.S. and with U.S. support during the HIV/AIDS pandemic in the 80s and 90s. So all those labs, all those research institutes that have been funded by PEPFAR, they're now working to help overcome the global pandemic of COVID-19. And this is something certainly that the U.S. is aware of and continue to want to support.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Patsy Wirakuswara at the White House for us. Patsy, great to see you. Thank you.
My pleasure, Heidi.
Well, U.S. President Joe Biden's first year in office has seen challenges to democracy and human rights at home and around the world. During this month's Summit for Democracy, hosted by President Biden, the U.S. announced it plans to launch programs to support independent media and anti-corruption efforts, as well as defend free and fair elections. Here again is VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wirakuswara with a story.
From robots patrolling behavior, facial recognition surveillance, to software that turns phones into spying devices. Such technology is often used by governments to target political opponents, activists, journalists, and minority groups.
We focused on the need to empower human rights defenders and make sure technology enables so much of our lives that is used to advance democracies, to lift people up, not to hold them down.
As the two-day virtual Summit for Democracy hosted by President Joe Biden wrapped up, the U.S., Australia, Denmark, and Norway announced an export control program to restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights.
We've seen the expanded misuse of spyware and other surveillance technology to monitor citizens far beyond what's needed to fight the virus. We've seen the rapid spread of disinformation and misinformation.
The U.S. also announced initiatives to empower human rights defenders, support free and fair elections, independent media, and anti-corruption efforts. Transparency International, a global civil society organization working in the fight against corruption, said the summit's initial outcomes are promising, but more needs to be done.
Other countries did not step up and commit to specific commitments the way the U.S. has. And so that is a concern. What are they actually going to come up with? They have a little bit more time. The U.S. government's giving them until January to come back with commitments.
Some say the $424 million in U.S. funds for these initiatives, still subject to congressional approval, barely meets the need to bolster democracy globally.
These are initiatives and monies that have been allocated already generally for democracy, for the rule of law and human rights. They get to repurpose them for a new announcement. But what we're not seeing here are really substantial sums that are being put on the table.
Democracy is also under attack by the global rise of populism, white supremacy, and extremism, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Polarization is undermining democratic institutions. Science and reason are under siege. All of these is eroding trust between people and democratic leaders and institutions.
An in-person summit is planned a year from now. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Join me on the next Straight Talk Africa as we continue our review of the news from Africa in 2021. We'll bring you the best of our interviews from this year, from a moment of African camaraderie at the Tokyo Olympics, men and mental health, and what Africa's young people really want. We'll look back at unfiltered moments and conversations with some of our guests in 2021. Join me, Haley Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is our show this week. Thank you to all my guests and all our show contributors. And of course, a huge thanks to all our new affiliate stations airing the show across the African continent. And to you, our audience, for always watching and always listening. Join us again next week. Do take care. Goodbye.